No one should be above the law, yet power politics is worsening a global justice gap, condemning millions of people to abuse, poverty and oppression. That's the message from the human rights group Amnesty International, whose annual report was released on Thursday. According to this State of the World's Human Rights Report, which documents abuses in 159 nations, powerful governments are guilty of blocking advances in international justice by standing above the law and putting political self-interest above the rights of their citizens.
What we mean is that today, too many perpetrators of some of the worst crimes are getting away with it, literally with murder in some cases, and also that people who are seeking to access justice for the implementation of rights such as their right to health, education, are also finding all kinds of obstacles, and governments are failing them in that regard.
Claudio Cordone is Amnesty's interim secretary general. He told me more about the main focus of the organization's work over this past year.
So we're calling on governments to ensure that systems of international justice such as the International Criminal Court are supported and can operate. And also we're calling on governments that will be reviewing the Millennium Development Goals shortly in September to make sure that these are not just political promises, but are actually enforceable, turned into enforceable rights.
Looking at that first point, the whole question of impunity, are there particular areas in which you're most concerned about this problem?
Our main concern is the double standards and the fact that some governments hold themselves above the law, for example, by not signing up to the International Criminal Court, or that they protect their allies in forums such as the Human Rights Council of the United Nations. One example of this last year was the way Sri Lanka got away without taking any measure of accountability for the final stages of the conflict between the government and the Tamil Tigers, that resulted in war crimes and other abuses by both sides. Despite repeated promises, the government has taken no serious measures of accountability. And this is why we're calling today, we're repeating our calls for the United Nations to set up an independent commission of inquiry into those abuses. This was just one example as to how power politics trumped justice last year.
It is an example that is often repeated in conflict zones, though. I mean, what else can you really do to try and ensure that those who are committing war crimes and total disregard for civilians, that they are brought to justice?
One thing that government can do is for all of them to sign up to the International Criminal Court. 111 countries are today state parties to the court. At the same time, government can enact legislation and equip themselves with ways to make sure that people who are responsible or accused of crimes under international law can be brought to court before their own national courts. Today, some 40 countries have done so, and we would like more of that. So that would then reinforce a system of international justice that would leave little room for people to get away, whether they have immunity at home, for example, but to get away with some of the worst crimes.
The International Criminal Court, it had a fairly difficult beginning, didn't it? And there are some countries who seem to remain firmly opposed to the idea. What can you do about that?
Well, partly by showing that the court is serious, that there is no risk of politicized prosecutions and so on. And I think the court has carefully chosen, or has been asked by some states to actually look into their situation. And in that respect, so for example, even the arrest warrant against President Omar al-Bashir of Sudan, which we see as a landmark last year, is an important step forward. It's been taken after careful consideration. And we've been disappointed by the reaction of the African Union that basically decided not to cooperate with the court, although it is important to underline the fact that states like South Africa and Botswana had actually dissociated themselves from that position.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the international review meeting on the ICC will be taking place in Africa, in Kampala, at the end of this month. What hopes do you have for that meeting?
Well, we look forward to that meeting first to strengthen the cooperation among states. And at the same time, we think the meeting is a good opportunity for the countries that have not yet signed up to the International Criminal Court to do so, to show that beyond the rhetoric of justice and so on, they actually do mean it when it comes to the hard facts of holding people to account for the brutality of crimes that are being committed in conflicts and outside conflicts in so many parts of the world.
Looking at some of the other areas that you're highlighting in this report, you're extremely concerned about increased reports of domestic violence against women, rape and sexual abuse of all kinds. This despite the fact that gender equality is one of the Millennium Development Goals. How can this be? I mean, it seems like a total failure of this particular goal.
Precisely, and that's why we want to see much more concrete engagement with the Millennium Development Goals. And one way to actually be able to achieve most of these goals is, in fact, to improve the status of women around the world. Much of the problems related to poverty, to maternal mortality, to education are due to the fact that women continue to be discriminated by states, by law, in the homes, that you have things such as enforced marriages, female genital mutilation, all kinds of other ways in which women are held back. And women are also not allowed really to participate in political processes, in the resolution of conflicts where their role will be determinant. So there is all these areas in which we would expect states to engage with if they are serious to redress the gender imbalance and to make sure that some of the scandals, such as violence against women, such as the other forms of oppression of women's rights, are actually effectively dealt with.
Closer to home, you're talking about your serious concerns over a rise in racism, xenophobia and intolerance in Europe and places like Central Asia as well.
That's correct. And we're seeing, for example, in the attitudes towards minorities such as the Roma. We have forced evictions, discrimination in school systems from in Italy to the Czech Republic to Hungary. We've seen still episodes of intolerance with regard to the gay community. And I think there is indeed a rise in Islamophobia, and in some respects this may also be behind the attempts to introduce bans on face veils, such as the one that's just been passed in Belgium and that is being discussed in France, which we think are measures that actually do not protect women's rights. They actually violate their freedom of expression, and it is another symptom of intolerance that unfortunately has been increasing in Europe and in Central Asia.
Given that these issues are of great concern to faith communities in many of the countries that you're looking at, what role do you see faith communities playing in this struggle for greater justice, greater rights, particularly for women?
I think faith communities, as well as people of faith together with other people where we share common values, particularly with regard to things such as poverty, the issue of discrimination and so on, can join forces. Let's not forget that all we're talking about is the implementation of the values of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that can and is supported by people of very different faiths and people of no faith at all. And our appeal is, again, for people to play their role, whatever they are, in their society, in government or elsewhere, to make sure that those ideals are turned into reality.
You note that the Millennium Development Goals review meeting is taking place in New York this September, and you're calling on world leaders to move from promises to legally enforceable commitments. How exactly do you do that?
Well, there are a number of ways in which states can turn these goals into an effective tool. One is to ensure the participation of people who are affected by these decisions in the decisions themselves. Far too many people are being excluded from the processes that lead to decisions on education, health, and so on. Another way is to make sure that there are proper mechanisms to hold governments to account for the policies that they adopt, whether these policies work or don't work. And ultimately, it's also important to make sure that people have access to justice systems. For example, if they are being wrongly evicted from their homes, they should be able to go to a judge and demand that they're being given compensation and another shelter. If people have to pay bribes in order to get proper health care, they should be able to use effectively the justice system to clamp down on these abuses. So there's a range of things, very concrete things, that government should be doing in order to turn these Millennium Development Goals into actual realities and not just promises.
Thanks there to Claudio Cordone, Interim Secretary General for the London-based Amnesty International.